Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working in...
An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. And they've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
And good afternoon, everybody. Chuck Bonnywell and Julie Hayden here with you. Truth Straight Up, the Chuck and Julie
BBS
Show.
Radio,
we're trying to get
TV.
Chuck connected with
We've
audio.
We've been doing radio
we
since
video.
Before
we're having a
the
audio
age of the dinosaur.
We're trying to have him
Look
go ahead
up.
And call in. Hopefully we'll
I
do that.
Know.
Otherwise,
That's
it's just
the way
me.
It is.
And then I could just say whatever I want. Ha-ha. Coming up here, and as soon as we get him on the phone, we're going to have a Real Clear Investigations reporter. If you ever go to Real Clear Politics, there is a tab at the top that has things like health, energy, investigations. And they do some great investigative work there. And John Murawski has a really interesting two-part series on woke medicine. I mean, we've heard about, and we'll ask him this as soon as we get him on the phone, we've heard about, you know, woke people being in schools, the equity theory in schools, things like that. But who knew that it was also going to be in medicine too, which is really where we don't need it. So, hey, Chuck, can you hear us at all? I can see you.
I can hear you.
Oh, yay. Perfect. Okay. Yay. We figured it out. The magician of audio helped you figure that out. And then also we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in Afghanistan, some really interesting developments going on there today. And then also Chuck, as promised, has some kind of exciting news, some interesting news about what's going on in the opt-out Save Our Republican Party race going on right now. It's kind of a little bit of inside politics, but it has a lot to do really with the future of the Colorado Republican Party. So Thomas, if you want to go ahead and give John a call, we can get right to that. But Chuck, while we're waiting for John, I know you've been working busy. The newspaper comes out tomorrow. So Chuck's been at the newspaper office all day. Kind of interesting. The Biden administration just continues to lie through its teeth to reporters. I mean, you've got Andrea Mitchell, for Pete's sakes, from MSNBC, a complete Democrat Biden suck-up, being critical and lengthy, criticizing questions. You know that you've kind of lost your, I don't know what, the puppy dog media people. They want us to believe that they finally figured out how many people were in Afghanistan. And initially they were saying, oh, it's like 10,000, 15,000. We don't know. They're a lot. That's why we couldn't evacuate them all, for God's sakes. Well, now, as it turns out, there are only 6,000 total. And of those, they've gotten about 4,500 out. There's maybe about 1,000 left, but they figure 500 of those people want to stay there. And I'm like, raise your hand if you believe that. So we'll talk about that later on. And the increasingly disturbing reality of what happens to those people, however many they are, there are, less than a week from today. But right now we do have John Murawski with us on the phone. Hey, John, thank you for your time and welcome to the Chuck and Julie Show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. How are you?
We're good. So I was saying, just kind of introducing you, you've got a two-part series up, which I read, and it's great, by the way, at Real Clear Politics. And essentially, you know, I'm a parent. We have a 10-year-old, and we've been doing a lot of stuff on our show, and obviously everybody has, on critical race theory in schools. But it's not just schools, basically, that have been impacted by this. You have a great series on the impact on medicine. And, you know, why don't I just sort of start out open-ended and have you say, you know, tell us a little bit about that. I was completely unaware of this. Why don't you bring us up to speed?
Yeah, basically, the same thing you're seeing that basically happened at the universities in the past, few decades has basically jumped the borders into all of, you know, every major social institution, including medicine. And so what you're seeing in K-12 schools is happening also in medicine. So one of the common things that anybody will recognize, and also it's particularly common in corporate workplaces with diversity and equity training. So one big component of this, of course, is diversity and equity training of doctors, where they have to come to sort of make their peace with the fact that they work for organizations that are created to distribute power to white people, to to harm non-white people. These organizations supposedly were created for that purpose, and because they were created for that purpose, they somehow maintain the spirit of the original purpose, and they continue harming black and brown bodies, as it is said in that field. And so they need to come to terms with this, and they need to affirmatively undo and dismantle these structures of oppression. And so they go through the same kind of training, and much of this is actually being, it's not actually just coming in from diversity consultants, it's actually being published in the most prestigious journals, such as the New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, and Lancet in England, and they're publishing hundreds of these kinds of articles calling for more diversity officers to run organizations and more diverse, diversity officers to get leadership roles. And the ultimate goal is to get equity, of course. Always the goal of all of this is equity, and equity is what is, quote-unquote, fair outcomes or proportional outcomes in terms of hiring. So you need to have higher proportional amount of African Americans throughout all levels of the medical profession, whether it's cardiology, oncology, surgery, neurology, also in the faculty ranks of universities, and also among in students, in other words, recruiting students, enrolling students, and of course this is a the tricky part of this is that right now. Non-white people, unless they're Asians and unless they're South Asians from India, tend to get worse scores and tend to get worse grades. And so you have to get around that fact, get around these lower SAT scores and lower grades in order to bring in more black students and black professors and black doctors. And so this, you have to have a theory criticizing or critiquing the validity of the scoring system and the grading system as being founded in oppressive structures. And of course, not everybody takes to this, because some people think that the grades are actually indicators of success and indicators of ability. So this obviously would cause, friction and dissatisfaction, which of course it is happening. That's what's happening right now. It's sweeping through the medical profession, and it's been happening for the past year and a half. Since really COVID is what did it, because COVID had disproportionate death rates among black people versus white people. And so the disproportionate death rates were presumed or asserted to be manifestations of systemic racism. Whenever you have a disparity of any sort, a racial disparity,
right,
according to critical race theory, the cause of that is systemic racism. And
well,
in order to undo that, you need to dismantle structures of oppression and redistribute power. And so it's become a common refrain. I mean, people are beginning, probably what I'm saying isn't completely new to your listeners now. They've heard this before. I guess what's new is that it would be happening with cardiologists and oncologists and neurologists, where, people are less, because if journalists or, people in marketing or journalism are teaching, I think most people are willing to be somewhat flexible on standards, because we, these fields aren't, the stakes aren't as high. But when you're dealing with surgery and medical decisions, then we're probably a little bit less likely to be flexible, because it involves human life and human health. On the other side, of course, the critical race theory contingent will tell you that precisely by hewing to the old rules, it's actually killing black people. And the way that the field of medicine is presented in these publications is the same way that they talk about the criminal justice system. It's a system that is designed and structured to maim and murder black and brown bodies. And that's how they describe the medical profession in these medical journals, which to me was a big shock, that they would use such strong language to describe the medical profession.
Wouldn't you think, there's so many points to take there, but the first one, let me kind of start at your last point. I would think if you're a doctor, most doctors I know, yes, they all want to make money, but also they tend to care about people and they want to help people. And isn't there any pushback from doctors saying, oh no, you may not even realize it. And of course, that's a microaggression, but actually you are becoming a doctor because your whole intent is to become part of this system that kills and maims black people. Aren't doctors saying, well, no, that didn't have anything to do with my decision. I mean, isn't there pushback?
Well, everybody says that, right? Everybody says that when they're faced with these kinds of allegations, or when they're presented with the theory that because you were born into a system of privilege, which is determined by your skin color, you are the beneficiary of unearned privileges, and your existence actually poses a threat or harm to people who aren't privileged in the system, which is, you know, this whole structure of oppressors and the oppressed. Most people, of course, resist, but right. the problem with resisting and with this is that the way it's structured is that one of the rules of critical race theory is that if you don't agree, you are part of the problem, and you're perpetuating harm and trauma and maiming and actually physical harm to people. So if you express dissenting opinions, it's not just that you're wrong, it's actually that you present a mortal threat to people. So it's very hard to disagree under the circumstances, because you're presented, you're characterized or mischaracterized as at least a microaggression, and potentially a macroaggression, which is an act of violence.
Right.
So, yes, there are doctors, and several doctors have initiated legal actions because they voiced opposition and they were demoted. But generally speaking, there's not a, you know, the opposition is basically has gone underground because people are protecting their jobs and protecting their reputations.
Right. What about, I think you hit another point I want to talk about, and that's what I think people may not realize is, like you said, it's one thing, and I, you know, if you're having diversity and you have essentially affirmative action in certain areas, you know, for instance, and you see in the schools, you know, they're talking about things like, well, math with has, you know, 3 + 3 = 6. It's, you know, that can be kind of racist. If somebody gets it wrong, it's because, you know, you're a racist and they've been, you know, they're victims there. But it seems to me, like you said, cardiologists, brain surgeons, there are certain things where actually a demonstrated skill and a demonstrated ability to perform certain procedures seems to be somewhat crucial. And you would want, you know, you don't want somebody who's like, okay, well, you know, being able to actually perform a surgery in which the patient lives, that's racist, and we don't want to actually count that. I mean, how do they respond to that?
The premise here is that white doctors have unconscious bias. So people who actually have good intentions, and no one is actually trying to harm black people, and no one is actually is a white supremacist in intent. But what happens is, because this is the way the theory works, is that we are all socially conditioned into these structures and systems that go unnamed and unidentified and unrecognized, that we perpetuate certain subtle behaviors that over time have a critical mass of an effect on people that actually result in disparate health outcomes. So there are hundreds, there have been hundreds and hundreds of papers written over the decades alleging or showing that black people get inferior care, that they wait longer in doctor's offices, that there's even research that that black people are undertreated in most areas, but in two areas, black people are overtreated, that means they're aggressively treated. And those two areas are basically castration and amputation. And this came out in a 2003 report put out by the Institute of Medicine, which has now been renamed the National Academy of Medicine. And apparently these disparities still hold. So there's a tremendous amount of research to back this up. And if you're a doctor, it's very hard just to say, I don't believe in the research, because you live and die by academic peer-reviewed research. And so there's tons of this research that has, you know, hundreds of reports. And it's very hard to stand up against it, because the research seems to point in one direction. Now, I've been trying to look at some of these papers. And if you look at the papers closely, I haven't read all. I mean, there are hundreds of papers, and there's no way I could possibly read hundreds of them. But I'm reading some of them. And if you look at them closely, it seems to me like there's a lot of interpretation, and the data could be interpreted in other ways. So the data it doesn't speak for itself in some self-evident manner, at least in the few papers that I've looked at. But there's a certain amount of wiggle room for interpretation. But, you know, there's obviously hundreds of papers. I haven't read them all. I'm not a doctor. Right. I'm not a scholar. So I'm just giving you a kind of informal response. But the other interesting point about this is that when it comes to family doctors, imagine that you go to your family doctor. You're going for a checkup with your child, or you're going for a regular checkup with your doctor. It probably does not occur to you to ask that doctor, what grade did you get in calculus, or how well did you do in organic chemistry, or what was your MCAT score? That's probably not very important to you, and because it doesn't really, because you sort of figured the doctor was, even if the doctor wasn't the best in his class or her class, the doctor was good enough. And one of the arguments made from the sort of critical race theory perspective is that ultimately the standards that we have put too much emphasis on these test scores, grades, and aptitude tests. And if we lowered them, we would still get very good doctors. But ultimately these test scores don't really, what they really measure is your status, your privilege, and your oppression. But they don't measure how good of a doctor you'll be over time. Because what these tests really measure is what kind of preparation you've received, what zip code you live in, what your family income is. And this is the same argument against the SAT score and against all standardized testing, that it is a neutral test that has racially disparate outcomes. So it's a neutral test, supposedly a neutral test, but it disadvantages black people because they keep on getting worse scores. And so the critical race theory interpretation here is that what the scores really measure is the disadvantages that black students have coming into the system at the beginning. But over time, if they're given support and help, over time, they'll become great doctors. And the other thing to keep in mind is that while white doctors tend to have negative effects on black patients, all this research concludes that black doctors do not have negative effects on white patients. So, you know, it sounds, you know, if you're hearing this for the first time, it just sounds like you need some time to process it because it sounds crazy. But this is like this consensus coming out of the activist wing of the public health profession. And
let me ask you this. I mean, taking the Hegelian dialectic, if this is the consensus, there will be the synthesis. There will be something that will come to opposing that. Well, what do you think that will be? Or is it just the old liberal standard of meritocracy? Or is there going to be a differing one that is radically different than critical race theory, but not just the old system?
That's a question that everybody wants to know. Where is this heading and how is it going to play out? And are we going to come out somewhere in the middle, or is it going to be one faction basically vanquishing the other faction, either through elections or some kind of organization?
But even the whole idea is that even if one vanquishes the other, another force arises. I mean, we fought fascism, then it was communism, and once you got rid of communism, then it was Islam. So assuming that the critical race theory wins, which is, it looks like it's doing, what will be the next thing to fight it?
You know, what will be the next thing? You're asking me what will be the next thing to fight critical race theory? I think that they will split into factions. Because these theories are always looking for problems to solve. They're always manufacturing or redefining problems because they exist for the purpose of problematizing, identifying new problems, waging war on those problems, and then using the infrastructure that they've developed to raise money and to self-fund themselves to attack some other problem. And ultimately, it could become like an autoimmune disorder where it turns on itself. Like as often happens in revolutions where they eat their own. I mean, that's one possible outcome. Another possible outcome, I think, would be that this movement would result in the hiring of more family doctors, nurse practitioners, and nurses who are African-American and Hispanic, who may not have met the very kind of rigid quantitative standards of aptitude or scoring that we currently have, but they're still actually quite good doctors, and they actually are helping people, disadvantaged people in urban clinics, rural clinics, and they're supplying much-needed work where currently that work is lacking. So there could be – see, the critics of critical race theory are interesting because they acknowledge that critical race theory, there's some element in there that might be actually helpful. And the helpful element here would be that we would actually have a lot of, you know, rural clinics that would gain doctors and nurses of color where they're currently lacking, and they would do important work where they're currently understaffed. So that would be the positive outcome. The outcome that people worried about is that it is so rigid that it requires just it's a quota system across the board without any regard for anything except political power and redistribution of power, and it is ultimately toxic. But
well, that's a problem.
It's hard to predict where it'll go.
And I think that's a problem with the whole concept of critical race theory, because, you know, like you're talking about, some of the issues that they're raising are decent issues. And I would agree, probably need some better solutions than we have right now. But to just assume that the system is systemically inherently racist, nothing you can do about it, we need to to me, there are certain areas that, you know, you would rather have the science and like the real science than politics. I mean, we've seen how politics entering medicine is playing out in COVID, right? If you're the average person out there, you get even John Mayer saying, hey, I got the vaccine to take one for the team, but I'm not going to get the booster shot. People just don't know who to believe anymore. And if all of a sudden you've got so much politics dominating what doctors can and can't say, how they treat people, what they give them, et cetera, I just think that in and of itself leads us down a very dangerous road. And I think this critical race theory this is part of this whole problem of politics, and I'm going to say progressive liberal politics destroying things.
Yeah, you know, I had a thought when you were talking. I know what I was going to say. What I was going to say is one of the features of critical race theory, which I would call a logical fallacy, and I think you probably would agree it's a logical fallacy, is that critical race theory doesn't recognize progress, which kind of leads to the joke that a progressive is someone who doesn't believe in progress. And the critical race theory actually illustrates that point, because they are the activist and the activist wing of the public health profession is very active in this. Are constantly raising examples from 50 years ago or 100 years ago as if they happened yesterday to prove that the system is rigged. So, you know, they'll talk about the Tuskegee syphilis experiments or experiments even on slaves or things that happened decades ago as if those things bear witness to the problems of today. And so, you know, your first reaction will be, well, that happened hundreds of, you know, decades right. ago, or even a century ago, or even a century and a half ago. Why are we bringing up now? We're in a completely different place than we were then. But it's, you know, and it's a distraction, and it takes up a lot of bandwidth to have to deal with all those historic examples. And one question I have is, why are we raising so many historic examples? Don't you have present-day examples? And the present-day examples, of course, are things like, for example, the disproportionate deaths from COVID of Black people. But those deaths are really due from the fact that Black people tend to work, lower income blue collar jobs where they can't do from home. Like, you know, they can't just get on a computer. They actually have to show up and work in a restaurant or work in some kind of public-facing field where they're encountering a lot of people. They have to use public transportation more often, and they often live in more crowded housing arrangements that expose them to more encountering. They just exposes them to catching the virus. But that is, you know, that is the downstream effect of what happened decades ago. But it's presented as if it's a present day. Systemic racism problem being caused by systems in place today, which to me are really different things.
Right.
They require different solutions. I mean, that kind of systemic racism of, you know, that people live in crowded housing because of redlining in the past, doesn't seem to me to require that you bring doctors and nurses in and right. talk about power imbalances and
right.
and white complicity and white and silence equals violence. But, you know, that doesn't right. seem to be the whole solution for that problem.
Well, one result of this, and theoretically could be, in fact, you have appreciably worse doctors and nurses who are African Americans. And there becomes a perception that if you get a doctor that it's an African American, he's an inferior doctor. And there's a reaction to that where, whether it's true or not, there'll be a fear of going, oh my God, you know, I'm putting my hands in this idiot. And I can't be assured they really did have go through the vigor of tough scholastic aptitude. And I think that's where you're really going to get, you know, yeah.
That's a common critique of affirmative action is that it casts a pall over all black people within an institution because you don't know which ones were let in on pure merit and which ones were let, which ones, you know, were accepted, you know, through the affirmative action pipeline. And so, and then the assumption is that it happened with all the people of color. And, of course, affirmative action advocates find that suggestion extremely offensive, even traumatic. But, you know, obviously unconsciously people, or even consciously, that will cross people's minds. And, you know, I don't know what the answer is. You know,
I think the answer from critical race theorists is to make sure you don't get a choice. One of the things is they have to make sure that as long as you don't have a choice and you have, and some doctor is better than no doctor and this is your only doctor you're going to get, it solves their problem. Because there's no result from people kind of go, I got a crummy doctor. Well, if you can't choose a different one, so get rid of choice. And the progressive left hates choice anyway. It's all the better.
Well, yeah, I mean, okay. I mean, but that's, yeah. But you still would be, if you have a black doctor, even without choice, you might have the same thought, right? I mean, right. the absence of choice wouldn't eliminate the doubt or the question as to whether this doctor is qualified. So I'm not sure that actually would solve the problem. But, you know, the issue with a lot of
these... The problem because it solves it for them because there's no difference between a good doctor and a bad doctor. You get, you know, it's what is that thing? What's his name's choice? You either take this horse or no horse altogether. You take this doctor or no doctor. And then it doesn't really matter if you're a good doctor or a bad doctor. You have forced patients. And so it all works out just beautifully under the socialist utopia.
Hey, you know what, Jack?
One of the problems of these social justice solutions is that they introduce new problems, and there seems to be a huge blind spot to the new problem. You know, every time you solve a problem, you're creating a new problem, but you seem to be oblivious to the problem that you're creating. And when people bring it up, then they simply have to go into equity re-education training.
Right.
to be treated for their implicit racism.
Hey, listen,
well,
Jack,
I want to get to the second part of what's happening these days is political treatment, and which we see incredibly these days in case of COVID. If you get a Trumpian doctor, you get ivermectin, you get a whole panoply of drugs that have proved highly effective, at least from what I can read, highly effective. But a lot of doctors go, oh, no, those are Trump drugs, and that's bad for you. We'll just put you on the ventilator.
Well, I'm not sure what I can say to that because it wasn't really part of my story, so it's not anything I researched or recorded. But I think generally speaking, the social justice ideologies are extremely political. They are, you know, this politics, in other words, it's scholarship in the service of politics, and politics is the, I would say, the master, and the scholarship is the servant, which is reverse of the traditional model. So everything is seen as political. Art is political. Journalism is political. Medicine is political. Math is political. And history is political. And it's hard to get away from that in that framework. And, you know, and the problem with it is that good solutions can be discounted because they're politically inconvenient, and bad solutions can be promoted. So, because ultimately the goal is a political goal and a sociological goal.
Right.
And, you know, that's the conflict that it creates.
Hey, John, listen, we're going to have to let you go. We've already taken way a lot of your time. You know, you're at Real Clear Politics. Please, you've been great. I was completely unaware of this. I recommend everybody go there and read his two-part series. Hey, and please keep in touch. We'd love to know when you got something else coming up again, too, okay?
Well, thank you very much. I was glad. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Sure, absolutely.
You bet. Take care.
Take care there, John Morawski. Thank you. You can find his work at realclearpolitics.com. Just go to investigations, and he's got this report. I mean, I was unaware of that. Let me real quick, Chuck, read some of the columns here. I mean, Dr. Donna has been talking about the Hippocratic Oath is optional now. Sandra, Leo says, I can't wait until we have civil engineers that didn't have to pass calculus because it would be racist. Can we have special signs on the bridges and dams that they design? No. That would be racist, Leo. I'm sorry. You're going to have to go to the re-education camp. Hey, want to switch gears here a little bit. Talk briefly about Afghanistan and then, Chuck, get to some of your news on the opt-out campaign, how that's going. But the first thing, I want to play a video. There is one good thing. In spite of the tragedy and everything going on and the chaos and confusion in Afghanistan, it is good for, I think, Republicans. And the Trump campaign put together, not the Trump campaign, because there isn't a Trump campaign, but the Trump Save America people put together a great ad that we want to play for you guys. Thomas, if we could play the Trump ad, please.
Is back.
The highest inflation rate in the
United States. The
southern border is collapsing.
The climb of COVID infections.
We amplify our power. We summoned a new strength.
This is a recruitment
Should
ad.
Should we be embarrassed?
Diplomacy is back.
Now the Taliban are back.
Kabul is not in an imminent threat environment.
The likelihood there's going to be the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely.
They own the whole country now, the Taliban.
The Taliban are now in complete control of Afghanistan. Complete chaos.
How did President Biden get this so wrong?
Well, first of all, the mission hasn't failed. Yeah.
If this isn't failure, what does failure look like exactly?
Biden, you destroyed not Afghanistan, but the world!
I don't care if you think I'm Satan reincarnate. Do I bear responsibility? Zero responsibility.
China is ready for friendly relations with the Taliban.
I feel like they're
going to
come in and kill
us. Cut out, everybody.
We have to ask the Taliban for permission for American citizens to leave. True or not true?
They are in control.
I can't think of anyone better to lead this operation than
they're just chanting death to America.
And you call yourself a president?
That's a good ad. I think that's an
effective. That's a great ad.
That's an effective ad. I know if you're listening, it's hard to tell. But if you get a chance, go to chuckandjulia.com and you can see the ad there, too. You know, and here again, Chuck, I know you were at the newspaper, so you didn't have time. But I listened to some of the State Department news conference, and Secretary of State Blinken said that actually there's only roughly, you know, about 500 Americans trapped still there. Now, meanwhile, everybody, you know, Katie McFarland went on and she said, no, there's thousands. She said there are people trapped in pockets all over the country. And basically, they said, you know, you got to get yourself to the airport. We're leaving August 31st. After that, you know, it's up to the Taliban what they do with you, ignoring the fact that the Taliban is apparently confiscating Western passports, not letting people in or through to the airport. You know, and then you said, well, it's your fault. It's the Americans' fault. If the Americans didn't leave, that's their problem. I mean, every time they open their mouth on this, they make it worse. And meanwhile, the deadline is getting closer and closer. And I imagine they've got to get the military out, too. They're already starting to withdraw the military. So it's only going to get more.
Well, that's not really true, Julie. I mean, we could say if the military doesn't get out, that they're on their own, too. They can join the other Americans and just try to do the best they can and hope the Taliban wants to let them go. I mean, it's unbelievable that it's this screwed up, and that now we've got 80,000 Afghans who will not be able to fit easily within the United States in many cases. The interpreters have a real advantage having known English, but there are lots of others who only speak Pashto or Dari. It's real hard to get a job when you can only speak Dari. They can't do anything worse to us. I mean, you know, we invade, and then kill, and then leave, and then take a huge chunk of their population. I mean,
there's another a new poll out now, a morning consult political poll, say only 24% of the people of registered voters that they surveyed think that the withdrawal is going well. And you got to know, who are those people? Are they like, Jen Psaki's mom, you know, Jill Biden, people like that. So no, it's going well. I mean, they're not fooling anybody when they get out there and they keep telling lies. I don't know if they just think they're just going to ride this through. I'm going to play another clip. Joe Biden, so he had some kind of news conference today, not even a news conference because he didn't take questions, but some kind of statement he made about something. And at the end, as usual, the reporter starts shouting questions at him. Well, I think they clearly gagged him. We're going to play that. And you need to, when there's silence, so that's just Joe Biden sitting there flipping through papers. And then they abruptly cut the microphone off. So, Thomas, if we could please play the Biden sound clip now.
And thank the press for being here. We're going to go private.
He's just flipping through pages. That's where they cut the microphone off. I mean, the reporters are shouting, what about the people who are going to be left in Afghanistan after the 31st? It's just ludicrous that they're trying to pretend like, and Jen Psaki is like, well, we've done a great job, that they're trying to pretend that they've done a good job. I think not only have they not done a good job, things could get way worse. And you and I talk about this. I mean, what do you have a prediction in terms of what you think the Taliban might do come September 1st, if you're an American and you like show up to catch a plane out at Kabul?
They'll probably let you go. They have no reason to want to keep Americans per se. They could
money,
hold them.
Money. Yeah.
Well, they can probably, you know, work out an arrangement where, remember that Obama, when Biden was vice president, was willing to trade $4 billion and five Taliban prisoners for one deserter. So if you have 10,000, you know, you could probably get a quick trillion from them and have it work out. I mean, I have to say, in this whole thing, the only people who seem to make any sense are the Taliban. I mean, they're the only ones who kind of go, well, you know, no, if you're still in our country after the date you said you're going to withdraw, you're an occupying force, and there'll be repercussions. And the Americans,
the Secretary of State also said, well, you know, that they will be, after they leave, because they were asking, well, okay, well, that's a Taliban, but what about ISIS? What about Al-Qaeda? And they're like, well, you know, we'll enlist the Taliban's help, you know, with that. And like Laura Logan pointed out, so we're going to ask a terrorist group's help to aid us in our counterterrorism, processes. It's like, it's just what Joe Biden has done to the country with this and the world. I just think they're going to be, and I don't think it's going to go well for the thousands of people who are still behind there.
They won't have too many reporters there, so there won't be too many reports on it. The corporate press will go back into its inflective protect Biden mode pretty soon. I mean, they had this moment of almost insanity where they actually acted like reporters and journalists. But not soon they'll go back to their usual reflexive Joe is great and Kamala is great and everyone else is a sexist kind of thing.
Right. Weird, though, too, is before all this started, there was another poll that came out of Rasmussen. So before, I think it was Rasmussen, before all this started, most people, I mean, the vast majority of people said, hey, we should get out of Afghanistan. That is completely right. That number is going down now, too. I think as people, we were talking about this earlier, I think as people, it's one thing to sit here in the United States and say, oh, yeah, we should get out of Afghanistan, no more nation building. And then you watch what happens when we do get out. out and you watch these desperate people saying, are you kidding? Are you leaving us to, you know, this horrid fate? I think it becomes, you know, it's a little bit harder to say, well, yeah, Joe Biden doesn't have a problem with it. But I think there are some Americans who are like, oh, didn't realize that that's what it meant. And I think that makes sense.
But what does it mean? I mean, I was one of those ones that looking at the pullout go, God. But the alternative is what? This massive drain on the United States, where literally the U.S. taxpayer was funding everybody. They were funding obviously the Afghan government and all the corrupt warlords and paying for all the equipment. But we're also supplying the budget of Pakistan and its ISI. Defense intelligence community, which in turn financed the Taliban. So we were paying everybody in that war was on the back of U.S. taxpayers. I mean, normally you have an enemy, at least you don't have to pay the taxes of the enemy.
I think clearly all of it is Joe Biden's fault, though. That's the one thing. The one that Joe Biden has indeed unified America, and it's into what a complete idiot he is. Well, do you want to switch gears now?
When you think about it, I mean, let's take the very lowest of rating is 41% of America thinks he's doing a good job. I mean, as you said, that 25% for the other one. What is going on with 41% of the people who can watch this debacle and kind of go, he's doing a good job? I mean, what does he have to do for that 41% not to do a good job?
Well, exactly. Like I said, which you always are suspicious of polls, but I think one thing that's clear, he is very much trending downward. And I think there are so many topics, whether people are kind of moving on from Afghanistan, they still got to fill the gas tank up every day. I mean, I filled mine up this morning. It was like, I was like, seriously? I'm not, like I said, I'm not filling up some giant RV. You know, I've got a Subaru. It's like, but anyway, hey, do you want to switch over and talk, give people an update on the opt-out campaign?
Yeah, the opt-out campaign is to try to save the Republican Party before its demise. Back in 2016, the left put on the ballot that have open primaries where if you're unaffiliated, you could vote in both the Democrat and Republican primaries. The net result of that, and I'm sure it was intended, is now Catherine Murdoch and the far left are going to poured millions in the 2020 election, and it was so successful it got the Murdoch four elected, that they are going to pour an incredible amount of money into the next primary in order to make sure that all will have are left-wing Republicans. And the only way you can stop that is say, no, only Republicans can vote in Republican primaries. And it's just so obvious that either that or you have a left-wing state, really a far left-wing state. The trouble, of course, is that your establishment has always believed that, we have more in common with the Democrats than we do with, you know, Reagan and Trump Republicans. So we'll never protest. We'll never fight against the Democrats and whatever they want to impose. And so now we've got this huge battle going on. It's in all the newspapers. I get 10 emails every day because the vote is among the State Central Committee, which is about 500 plus people. But the great news
is coming up in a couple of weeks, right?
September 18th. Yeah, not far away at all. But one of the great news, I mean, we've had leadership in this state, in the Republican Party, that has been just atrocious, such that, you know, the former chairs are endorsed Biden and other things. For the first time ever, we have a vice chair, Priscilla Rahm, who is actually siding with the grassroots, and she's put out a letter that's arriving in people's mailboxes. Now those are the people who'll be voting on this.
The central committee members, not the general public,
Yeah, right. But she, and of course they're all attacking her. The John Calderas and all the purportedly conservatives.
Point out. I mean, I like John Caldera, but let's be clear. He gets his money. He gets his money from the establishment Republicans who don't like this idea. And as I understand it, John Caldera is not a registered Republican. So, I mean, with all due respect,
he's not a Republican at all.
Quit commenting. It'd be like me. I mean, here's the way they talk. I mean, go find your own, have an independent candidate. You don't want to be a Democrat. You don't want to be a Republican. Fine. But quit telling the Republican Party what to do. It'd be like if I was saying earlier today to you, it's like, it'd be like me saying, hey, I want to vote on the board of your HOA. I don't live there. Don't even have anything to do with you. But I feel like
I don't like your neighborhood at all, but I want to elect the president of your
HOA. Well, I want to try to help my property rates. So I'm going to say that every house in your neighborhood, you know, has to be painted black or something like that. And I mean, that's the equivalent of it. And you would be like, well, you don't even live here. You can't vote here. This concept that you should be able to vote in some group that you're not even a part of. And there's got to be a reason you're not part of it, because you don't like it, right? Otherwise, you'd be a part of it. So why are we letting people who don't like us vote in our primaries? And again, people like courageous Priscilla Rahm and some of the other people, Randy Corcoran, you, Dave Williams, who've come forward, are taking, as always, an incredible amount of flack from people who are like, hey, you're rocking our boat here. You know, the swamp is, we need this to keep us going. But you guys have just done a great job.
Well, I think it finally exposes people. If you're a swino or a rhino, you know, you had to come out and demonstrate that. And we've had party chairs and all that. So you kind of go, I didn't know you were really a left winger. And it really is. Either we win or the Republican Party will maybe even go to the left of the Democratic Party, be more progressive than the Democratic Party, because the only real money in there will be Catherine Murdoch's.
And so you can see some of the people that she got, the Catherine Murdoch, the Democrat money, got elected. The folks at Liberty Scorecard, they rate the state legislators and their votes. And in terms of just basic sort of liberty, which would be considered Republican principles, they don't really care who you are. It's just sort of a pretty, I would say, it's pretty straightforward, I guess. You can. And so the people that Catherine Murdoch got elected get F's on that. They vote with the Democrats. So the establishment, they say, well, it's better to have at least a Republican than a Democrat. Not really. Not if they're going to vote with the Democrats straight down the thing. They might as well be a Democrat then.
Well, they don't vote for them straight down the thing because they don't want to be, you know, overly exposed. But whenever the Democrats really need them to sign on to some far left legislation to make it "quote unquote bipartisan," they do, and you know, it's the system you want purportedly. If you're not a progressive, is you get a choice. You have a choice between different principles and different ways of solving problems and different ideas. What good does it do to have just one left wing big government uniparty?
Not only do you have no choice, but it's destroying the state, right? I mean, let me read real quick some comments. Sandra is saying, so Priscilla's behind you, Chuck in the group, wonderful news. Dr. Donna is saying, let Republicans vote for Republicans. Sandra agrees. And then she notes, having Priscilla's support is going to burn Peter Boyle's behind, LOL. Well, and again, I don't think I like Peter Boyle's, but he's not a registered Republican either. So, that's great that they get to win. That'd be like me calling up Ted Trimpa and getting offended that he's not taking my advice when I tell him how to run the Democrat Party. It'd be like, well, why should I listen to you? I think it's good. And I think you guys have done a good job. This went from a topic that was just really in the weeds to, and I think the reason is because people realize how important it is to have real Republicans in Republican races. People can still vote. You know, they keep saying you're going to disenfranchise the unaffiliated voter. It's like, no, you're not. They can still vote. They can vote in the general election. And if they want to vote in the Republican primary, all they have to do is affiliate for that time as a Republican. I mean, it's not hard at all to do.
Yeah, and then at least you'd have a choice election time comes. It's not Tweedledum, Tweedledee. You got to go one that believes in small government, one that believes in big government. Well, maybe there's some things where big government's good. Maybe there's some things that little government is good. But if the answer is always the same and it's just your choice is no choice,
right.
then Colorado will become what Mark Twain said about voting. He's saying if voting really mattered, they wouldn't let us do it.
Right.
And that's what Colorado will be. It'll be just kind of, it'll be like in the old Soviet Union. You know, they take the day off, they got extra rations, and they could all go in and just pull the lever, and it made absolutely no difference.
Right, and then we can all go to our critical race theory doctor.
And then we'll be locked down.
Exactly. All right, well, Chuck, I know you had some stuff to do, so we wanted to end just a little bit earlier than usual today. So I want to thank John Murkowski. Thanks to everybody listening on Zoom. Remember, you can catch all of the podcasts at chuckandjulie.com. We have a link there to listen live if you want to. And I always let me give out the Zoom number, too, if people want to go to zoom.us. It's 209-576-423. That's 209-576-423. In the meantime, though, Dave Bieri, Chuck, he's one of your favorites, is going to be here on Party Friday. Talk a little bit about inflation. What a party topic. Talk about about the European reaction or the reaction in Europe to this whole Afghanistan crisis thing and all kinds of other stuff, too. So that'll wrap it up for us. Chuck, you want to say goodbye?
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Oh, see you Party Friday, everybody.